Our subject this evening is the covenant and baptism. Just as a real quick reminder, we've been talking about the Christ's covenant and your life, especially thinking about how God's covenant of grace is applied to us recently. And so our recent studies have looked at the means of grace, the preaching of the word, the Lord's Supper. So tonight we'll be thinking about how baptism communicates God's covenant to us. There are many promises that come through, and let me preface this by saying, like I did last week with the Lord's Supper, is that there's a lot that could be said about baptism and a lot of details that might be explored, but I'm going to narrow my focus this evening and look especially about the connection of baptism to the covenant. Well, remember that a covenant is a bond of blood sovereignly administrated that involves promises and responsibilities. And there are many promises that are conveyed in baptism. In the case of baptism, it's a promise that actually goes all the way back into the Old Testament and really captures all of the covenantal language from the very beginning, starting at Genesis chapter 3, where God promises to claim a people to himself. And there's a corporate nature to that. And so God says to Adam and Eve, I will be your God, or says to Adam and Eve that the seed of the woman, or the offspring of the woman, would crush the head of the offspring of the serpent. And there's the beginning there of a covenantal way of looking at God's dealings with mankind that is taken up especially when God deals with Abraham. When God promised Abraham, I will be your God and you will be my people, I will be a God to you and your children after you, he gave not only a promise, but he gave a sign of that promise to Abraham. The promise was to Abraham and Sarah. And I want to ask the children a trivia question here. Not a trivia question, but the promise came to Abraham and Sarah. But how many children did Abraham and Sarah have at the time that God promised them these many, many children? Mary?
Technically zero.
And actually zero. they didn't have any children whatsoever. And how old were they? Does anybody know? Rachel? Abraham was 100 years old. Yeah. David?
And Sarah was, she was 90.
Uh-huh, that's right. That's right. And Joseph? You confirming that? You want? Abraham was... That's right. Abraham was 100 years old. Now, you may not know this, but your daddy and mommy are not that old yet. They may seem really old to you. but they would have to be sometimes twice as old, sometimes three times as old as that to be as old as Abraham and Sarah were in this story. Even older than your grandparents. Many of you have grandparents that are still living, and it would be older than them. Yes, Mary? Is she really? Wow. Can you imagine her having a baby? It's hard to imagine someone that old having a baby. Well, you might by that story just remember and capture some of the wonderfulness of God's dealings with mankind, that he would sovereignly choose to bless mankind through Abraham and Sarah, who naturally could not have children, both because of their age and because of Sarah was barren. Yes, David?
Years old.
Wow, that's...
And still living on her own.
That's really nice, yeah.
And her daddy died.
That's right. That's right. Well, the point of what I'm wanting you to think about is that God gave a child to Abraham and Sarah, a child of promise, and that child of promise was a prefiguring of another child of promise, a grandchild, a great, 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 ever so great grandchild, who would be Jesus Christ. And God made a promise to Abraham and Sarah that he would be God to them and to their children after them, and that in Abraham's descendants, all the nations of the earth would be blessed. That's a promise of Jesus, that God would bring blessing to the nations through Jesus. And God gave a sign to that promise, and that sign was circumcision. It was a sign in the Old Testament to help the Israelites understand that the children born to the Jews were considered to be special in God's eyes. They were part of what we would call a covenant community. They were marked by the sign of the covenant so that they would know a special relationship that they had with God. There's a representation and a communication of God's grace that is in the covenant and in the covenant promise. One commentator named Patrick Fairburn calls this a distinct badge of the covenant because it was peculiarly fitted for symbolically expressing the spiritual character and design of the covenant. Oh, in a visible and in a tangible way, the sign testifies that God is faithful to his covenant. In Genesis 17, God says, "This is my covenant which you shall keep between me and you and your descendants after you. Every male child among you shall be circumcised, and you shall be circumcised in the flesh of your foreskins, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and you." So what I want you to see is the connection between a covenant promise and covenant sign that is given. In this case, the covenant promise is made to Abraham and Sarah, and the sign is given to them, and is a covenant that was made in their flesh. And there's an equation there that the sign signifies something. It stands for something. It doesn't accomplish what it promises, but it stands for something. It stands for God's covenant. So what does this have to do with baptism? Well, remember that I'm demonstrating that baptism communicates the blessings of God's covenant. And circumcision was a symbol to the Israelites that they were part of God's covenant people. From the time they were born, they were marked as such. And in general, we can see how God has chosen to work through generations throughout the account of scriptures. He gives promises and commands, and there's responsibilities that flow from this covenant. Gave his command and promise to Abraham and to his children after him, even though they weren't even born yet, even though they were childless at the time. God chose to bless through Abraham, and then Isaac, and then Jacob, and then Jesus. He chose to send the Messiah, Jesus Christ, through Abraham's descendants. That as we move then into the birth of Christ and into the New Testament era, we see that the promises that God made to Abraham come to their fulfillment in Jesus Christ. There's a promise that God had made that the Messiah would come from the seed of Abraham. A promise that was made that in the descendants of Abraham, in that coming seed, all the nations of the earth would be blessed. We see then in the New Testament, especially through what the Apostle Paul says, that those who have faith in Christ come to be counted as children of Abraham. You might read through the book of Galatians again, and while there's an answering there of a specific question about circumcision, it has a lot to do with our New Testament expression of faith. In fact, as you read through that, the relationship between circumcision and faith is being worked out by Paul, and as a byproduct of that, we learn about that old covenant sign as well as our relationship to God in the New Testament, New Testament expressions of that. So Paul says that that believers in Jesus Christ are counted to be children of Abraham. In a sense, not in a sense, but in a real way, the church is the fulfillment of God's promise to Abraham to be our God and a God to our children after us. You can begin to sense some of the greatness of what God is doing and the faithfulness of His covenant love that He's accomplishing. So just like in the Old Testament where God gave a sign, a physical sign to represent and to communicate the covenant, His covenant love to Abraham, so too God has given a New Testament sign, a New Testament or a new way of communicating the very same things that He did through circumcision. And that New Testament sign is baptism. As I said in the book of Galatians, there is the question that the Galatians were asking. They were, in fact, it was asked a lot in that New Testament era, the relationship of Gentile believers to what was born out of a Jewish faith. Should Gentile believers be circumcised? Well, let me ask you to answer that question. Should Gentile believers be circumcised as a requirement for salvation or a statement of faith? Mary Abigail?
But circumcision is never a requirement for salvation.
A very good answer. Circumcision was never required as part of salvation. It was a demonstration of God's covenant love, even in the Old Testament. So neither does it continue to be a requirement for salvation. I did say that quite right. It does not continue as a sign of the covenant. Instead, God has replaced the sign of circumcision with baptism. And Abigail has answered well that it's not a requirement for salvation. It's salvation never was and never will be faith plus anything else. And that's the point of Galatians, is to say, if you add anything to salvation by faith alone, then you have torpedoed the gospel. It is worthless. Instead, salvation is only by faith alone. It always has been, and it always will be. So, in direct answer, circumcision is not given for that purpose. It's given as a sign of being part of the covenant community and of the blessings and promises of God. And now, then, in the New Testament, we have a new sign that's given to that. I especially like Colossians 2, 11 and 12 as an example of that. Now, who would read Colossians 2, 11 and 12 for us? Sam? Yeah.
In him also you are circumcised with the circumcision made without hands, by putting off the body of the flesh by the circumcision of faith, being buried with him in baptism, in which you were also raised with him through faith in the powerful working of God who raised him from the dead.
I often turn to this passage when the question is raised about the promises of God, especially to our children, and why we participate in, or why we practice infant baptism. And the answer that Paul gives is that what is signified in circumcision is signified in baptism as well. And the promise of God, and I've been making making an emphasis on the promises of God that go back to Abraham in this lesson, and wanting to really emphasize that. So think about what Paul is saying in this passage. As I have treated this before, I'll just give some highlights to this passage. Remember that Paul is writing to a generally Gentile church at this point. That means that most of them would not have received circumcision. But it's clear that there's a question about the relationship of Gentiles and Jewish Christians. And in this context, Paul says to a predominantly Gentile believers' church that you were circumcised, not with a physical circumcision, but with what he calls a circumcision made without hands, and identifies it especially by the circumcision of Christ. He's identifying our union with him that's signified then in the fact that we are buried with him in baptism. So in our baptism, we have our union with Christ signified, and all of the blessings that are part of the promises of circumcision are applied to us and to our children after us. In the Old Testament, the rite of circumcision was given to signify the inclusion of a people into a covenant community. That took place for those that were adults that came into that covenant community, that they were given that sign. It was also then given to the children of the Jews as a sign that they were part of that covenant community. So too, in this New Testament era, we look to our union with Christ as being part of the blessing of God's covenant of grace, and that there is a promise of being included in the covenant community. For those who profess Christ as adults, we practice adult baptism. We do believe in baptizing those who are adults who have not been baptized before as a sign both to them and to the world that they are part of that covenant community. But along with that, we see a connection to the promises of God that stretch all the way back to Abraham and back to Adam and Eve, that God deals not just individually with his people, but he deals corporately, and that there are blessings that God gives to a covenant community. And that means that even the children of believers are counted to be part of that covenant community. Denis Proutot describes in his book, speaking to a junior high class, many of which were not, I think maybe all of which were not communicant members yet, and he asked them, how many of you are members of the church? And it's a little bit of a trick question, because oftentimes we think of it as being identified with communicant membership. And he said there was one young girl who raised her hand, and she said that her parents had had her baptized, and that she was a member of the church. And she was right, that baptized children are members of the church. and are considered members of the church. And there are promises and benefits that that implies. That means that we consider children to be set apart to belong to the Lord. That doesn't mean that we consider them to have saving faith. We believe that they too are sinners needing Jesus Christ and needing their hearts to be circumcised and their hearts to be changed by faith. But in resting on the promises of God, a promise that says, I will be a God to you and to your children after you, we apply the covenant sign to our children, asking that God would bless with fruit, bless with faith our covenant children. So we consider our baptized children as members of the church. One of the applications that I'd like to make in regards to this is to think about our children as members of the covenant community. To use a phrase again that Denny used, to think of our children otherwise is to treat them as what he calls privileged pagans. Do you catch his drift there? So if God does not deal covenantally with our children, then we're saying something about children before they are baptized. What are we saying? Be honest. They're not Christians. They're outside of the covenant. They're pagans. And oftentimes churches will unknowingly treat their children differently, and they may think that they are doing their children a service, but they are not. And Denny Pruteau brings up is the practice of separating children out from the worship of the Lord to go elsewhere until some such time that they are deemed adult enough to be responsible or to be in the service. What that communicates to children and young people is that you don't belong here in the worship of God. You don't belong in the covenant community. Now, as I said, I think there's a desire that often motivates that. There, people are wanting to speak to children in ways that they understand, but they in a sense do a disservice by separating them out, and often separating them out for until they reach high school or so, and treat them as different. There is kind of a growing fad in some of these churches right now called family integrated churches, which is recognizing some of the assumptions that approach is taking of treating our children differently. And if you haven't heard that phrase, I want you to be aware of it, because it is kind of there's a growing interest in the broader church, and the effort is to say, no, our children should be with us. There are some dangers along with this teaching that I won't go into tonight, but I want you to be aware of that and to recognize that we have said very deliberately that children are to be included in our services. In fact, each week in the bulletin you might gloss over it right now, but we have childcare that's provided. We do have a nursery. We provide so that children can be cared for and that need special attention. But we say we believe that children ought to be a part of this, and so we're okay to having some background noise in our services, both morning and evening. It is appropriate to talk to children in age-appropriate ways. It's appropriate to have Sunday schools and things like that where our children can be instructed and trained, and there's some biblical reasons for that I could go into if you would ask me about that later. Family Integrated says never ever separate out the children. Just a little slice there. Coming back then to the covenant and baptism, just to wrap it up, I want to say again that we believe that the baptism communicates God's faithful love, that there's a sign that's given to us that marks us as being included in the covenant community, that we are initiated into that by God's faithful and covenant love. And that there's a corporate aspect to that. The corporate aspect being that God promises to be a God to you and to your children after you. There's a lot more that can be said about baptism, but I'll leave that for other days. Any questions that you might have on the relationship between baptism and the covenant? Tonight, I'd like to share prayer requests, and we haven't done this in a while. I'd like to divide up in small groups, and the shape of the Spittler's house lends to that very nicely. We have three kind of general areas that we can divide up into and into small groups to pray for each other. So let's share our prayer requests together, and then we'll divide up.